Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, I'm Helen, and Stephen is quietly coughing himself into a flux somewhere. So it's just me on the intro, but he will be joining us in a moment to talk about all things Brexit. We've got the Attorney General's legal advice. We've got the ECJ judgment. It is almost too exciting. Plus, we're going to talk about the case of Kate Osamore and what it means for our democratic norms. Stephen, I'm so pumped to talk about Brexit that I nearly released my own workout video about it, like Aaron Bastani, but thankfully for our listeners, I have not. Tell me all about Brexit.
Well, so in some ways, the story hasn't moved along all that much. The government is heading for inevitable defeat, but since our last exciting adventure, one of the things we were talking about was that it was not certain how a second referendum could possibly pass the House of Commons without a shift in the politics of the Conservative Party, and at least a sizable number of Conservatives who had not previously expressed particularly strong pro-European sentiments deciding they wanted to back a referendum rerun. Since our last podcast...
So this is the resignation of Sam Gyimah, who was the Universities and Science Minister.
Yeah, I just say that is one of the two sort of noteworthy Brexit events.
So hang on a minute, Sam Gyimah had been previously at prisons before that?
Yes.
And is a Remainer?
Yep.
And is generally pretty well liked, pretty well regarded. And why is he more important than, I don't know, I guess he's as important as Joe Johnson in his way. Why is he more important than Minister for Paperclips number 3, who resigned at the same time that Dominic Raab and Esther Vaide did?
Pretty much all of the other resignations from the government over the withdrawal agreement have been people who have wanted a harder Brexit. And I would say that Sam Gyimah is more important than Joe Johnson because Joe Johnson is known as someone who is more pro-European than the average Conservative, right? Yeah, he's someone who is seen as someone who, if he was going to make a big principled stand to blow up his promising career, you would kind of go, well, that's surprising, but within the sphere of...
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, Sam Gyimah is someone who was a Remainer partly because he thought it was best on balance, but also because of his close political proximity to David Cameron. I mean, basically, if you kind of think about pro-European conservatism as a sliding scale, starting with Ken Clark and Anna Soubry, then you kind of have your sort of like your Nicky Morgans, Nick Moleses, then you sort of have Joe Johnson... And then at the end of the scale of pro-Europeanism, you'd have, say, Sajid Javid or Jeremy Hunt, right?
People who obviously... Wait a minute, the furthest out is like John Redwood.
But I'm talking about people who are notionally pro, who vote...
Oh, so, I see.
And then basically, Sam Gyimah would be roughly between your kind of... Now, obviously...
He's kind of the median Tory Remainer, is what
you're saying. Yeah, this thing. So obviously, one swallow does not make a summer or a spring or whatever season it is, and a swallow is meant to augur. But basically, before, if someone had said, will there be a second referendum, you go, no. Unless you start to see someone like... Sam Gyimah resign. It's not even remotely plausible from a mathematical perspective how you could get 325 votes. It's still a very big ask, but it's basically gone from being something that you can go, no, to something you can go, probably not.
Okay, so that's one useful thing that's happened this week. The other couple of things that have happened is the ECJ's top judge has released his legal ruling on whether or not Article 50 can be revoked. This is the key part, unilaterally. So, i.e. Britain can go like, tixies, bexies, and then doesn't have to wait for the other 27 countries to sign it off. Now, as I understand it, his rulings are gone along with by the EU, what, about 4/5 of the time? Is that about right?
So basically, it's an indicative opinion. And in some ways, the kind of useful, I was about to say this, the layman's way to understand it, the politico's way to understand it is it's a bit like the first seat to declare on election night. Sometimes the first seat to declare on election night, the swing is not the same, it doesn't tell you very much. A lot of the time, even if the result is different, the swing will be indicative. And essentially, the Advocate General's opinion is like that as far as the final ruling. He has said Article 50 can be revoked by the departing nation. There are a couple of important caveats. The first is that it would require an act of Parliament.
And therefore 325 votes.
325 votes, which is difficult. The second is that the opinion is clearly shaped in a way that you can't simply go... So basically, if you have a second referendum, you would need to extend Article 50 because there isn't time for one. And the extension does have a unilateral right of veto by any other member state.
So hang on a minute. If we asked, can we have another 6 months to have a referendum, then Spain can go, no, because we're very upset about Gibraltar, soz lads.
Yeah.
But the theory is that if we go, actually, we want to bin the whole thing off, maybe forever, maybe only for a bit, then they can't veto us.
Yes, but the crucial bit is the maybe only for a bit. The EU's lawyers said in their argument, and I imagine will probably seek to appeal it if the ruling does follow the opinion, then basically what do you do if you have a situation where you create the ability for the departing member state
to hokey cokey?
Yeah, to kind of continually go, hey, I'm Matteo Salvini, I'm just going to, to revoke and not revoke as I so desire.
They could have a revoke button on his desk and he could just press it every so often when he just wanted to annoy the EU.
So yeah, so there are various ways and it will be designed so you can't do it solely to give yourself extra time. Now, I mean, in some ways, this is going to sound more critical than I mean it to be, because I don't really know sort of what, kind of second referendums could have done differently on this one. But one problem is that pro-Europeans have been a lot better at winning legal battles than they have political ones.
So on things like the meaningful vote, for example, Gina Miller's court case, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, the Gina Miller court case is sort of the example, right? Successfully got the right for Parliament to vote. Parliament then went, we don't need any caveats. Where we're going, we don't need roads. And you end up with Article 50 triggered, the default scenario of no deal set for the 29th of March 2019. Yeah, I mean, I'm semi-dubious as to what you actually could do, short of like a kind of forcing Remainers to move into constituencies and voted heavily to leave. So then you deal with the fact and there's a critical mass of Labour MPs who go, yeah, we would definitely lose our jobs if we did that. And you also get another bunch of Remainers.
You vote for a second referendum.
Yeah, a bunch of Remainers to join the Conservative Party and vote for the next Conservative leadership election. I mean, although those were both things that Nick Clegg kind of semi-seriously suggested people should do, the problem is although they're technically correct, they're eye-catching things, and if you say, if I wanted to get loads of angry traffic, if I did a piece headline, Remainers should just join the Tories, I mean, it would
be... Remainers should just move to Grimsby and join the Tories.
Yeah, those things would both be technically correct points. Mm. It's just...
No one's going to do them.
They're not... They are just not going to happen. But, I just think... I think it's a useful position for the EU to be clarifying the legal status around Article 50. It helps Theresa May because she can now much more credibly say to Brexiteers, look...
My deal. They might have a people's vote and then who knows what will happen.
Yeah.
Not to be unparochial for like 2 minutes, but the ruling is very interesting as well, given that, I mean, you've said all along from the people that you were talking to, the Article 50 was designed as a kind of punishment process, right? It was there to be used and invoked against an Eastern European nation that slid towards authoritarianism. Well, there are some at the moment. Viktor Orban's Hungary has already been censured. Well, there was a motion of censure in the European Parliament, which Tory MPs did not vote for, drawing them the condemnation of both the Board of Deputies of British Jews and the Muslim Council of Britain. But if actually the EU finds out that it has weakened its ability to kind of to drum people out, that is something that the EU will probably want to look at in the future too, right?
Well, yeah. So John Kerr's idea of what of Article 50 would be used in is he imagined a scenario in which one of the new Eastern Bloc countries slides into authoritarianism, it has its voting rights withdrawn, and then it, in a state of protest, it triggers Article 50 and leaves. I mean, and also, it is designed to create leverage and to create a cliff edge, right? Yeah, and I think one of the myths about, when people say, oh, she should have tried to leave through some method other than Article 50, you would have to be dumb as a brick in order to ever allow the departing nation not to use Article 50 as its exit mechanism.
This is the theory that we should have repealed the, 1975 European Communities Act or something like that, and done it that way.
Yeah.
I probably should know this already, so I do not. Does the EU actually have a way to force people out if they don't want to go? Say it's 10 years down the line, Viktor Orban is now dictator for life in Hungary, the independent judiciary is gone, the last newspaper is closed, gerrymandering has reached mad levels. Is there any mechanism for the EU to go, you're really not actually a democracy anymore, we'd like you to leave, thanks?
I don't believe so. There are a variety of sanctions, both financial and in terms of voting rights. So you can have a situation where you are not receiving, yeah, in which, and yeah, partly because
cut off
of
the cash, right? I guess that's one of the things that you can do
there
if you're a net recipient of EU funds.
There are ways in your EU membership can become less congenial, but no, the idea is envisaged that an exit will be a decision taken by the departing nation, not that it will be exited.
One final thing before we move on. Geoffrey Cox, the Attorney General. There seems to be a weird thing where Tories have got this thing about how lovely his voice is. Like he's sort of, I don't know, a charming old wizard. But anyway, that's irrelevant to my question, which is about his legal advice as Attorney General. Which is, again, giving me such flashbacks to the Iraq War. He's been refusing to publish anything other than the summary of it. Labour have been trying to say that's contempt of Parliament. Does it matter? Is it just a useful political bludgeon for Labour to have legal advice that says presumably we'll be a lot poorer and that is the official considered view of the government?
Well, no, so the legal advice is not going to touch on issues of poverty. It will just touch on, you know, what the legal reality will be.
So what does that mean?
So just what is the legal status of the backstop? What does that mean for our relationship? What does that mean for the ECJ? Now, so I think...
So why don't they want it out? Because is it going to say a lot of things that Conservative Brexiteers are going to have a proper faint at?
Yeah, I mean, I think essentially, right, there are two subplots here. One, there is the legal judgment going to say anything that we don't know? No. So the fundamental difference is with the war against Iraq, obviously the government's contention was that the war was legal, and the contention of some opponents of the war was that the war was illegal. So therefore, the substance of what Goldsmith was saying was therefore important, because it was contended. No lawyer disputes that there is no unilateral right of exit from the backstop. Yeah, that you are still subject to the strictures of the European Court, right? So in some ways, the actual substance of the legal documents makes no sense, and it purely is about the kind of Westminster theatre of Geoffrey Cox saying the backstop is indeed a backstop, and a bunch of Conservative MPs going whoa, and then a bunch of people in the lobby tweeting wow, huge if true. But there is a really important principle that Parliament has, that the government is not the client. Parliament is the client of the Attorney General. Parliament has asked for the legal documents, and therefore they ought to receive it, and it is part of our general really troubling erosion of our norms.
Well, we haven't got time to talk about our erosion of norms. May I just say that how much I enjoyed your column in the Christmas issue, which will be out by the time that people listen to this. And if anyone is interested, Stephen has been eating a lot less meat this year. So while you're writing about the erosion of our norms, perhaps people could send in exciting vegetarian recipes to him.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And now it's time for a section we like to call... yeah. Have you got TB? I think is the question I'm asking as I'm trapped in this very small room with you. Stephen, I think that the most interesting question is, why wasn't everyone able to agree a clearly established set of facts which you could all hold in your mind at the same time around the case of Kate Ozamore? So this is the former Labour Shadow DFID minister who employs her son, Ishmael, who's 29, in her private office. He was also a councillor in Haringey. He pleaded guilty to possession of about £2,500 worth of drugs at a music festival. He's resigned from the council, stayed in her office. She wrote a letter in support of his character, which, fair enough, she is his mum. That is the kind of thing that mums tend to do, but was very cagey about revealing it. The Times and other newspapers eventually got it revealed that she was one of the people who'd written these letters, at which point she flipped out the reporter who went to doorstep her to get comment from her, threatened him with a bat, which you'll notice it's never specified what kind of bat, baseball, cricket, fruit, and then threw a bucket of water over him. I found this, trying to follow this story, was like entering a nest of partisan iniquity, right? It's that just everybody's take seemed so framed by whether or not they were on her side or not.
So yeah, so the central problem was that she gave misleading answers about when she knew about the charge. But I mean, it is, see, you said, and I wasn't going to get to talk about the erosion of our norms, right? So to take, you know, one particular example, Trevor Kavanagh saying, well, what would have happened if this had been a Conservative minister? And she's like, well, we know that actually it would be exactly the same, which is that if the minister didn't want to resign, they would not face any pressure to do so, right? So this is the kind of really troubling place I think we're in, which is actually the kind of big macro story, which is, why did Amber Rudd resign over Windrush? Downing Street wanted to keep hold of her. It was because she thought she needed to go. Why did Esther McVeigh not resign when she was found to have lied to Parliament? Because she didn't want to go, and Downing Street doesn't believe that to be a thing that's worth enforcing. Why has Ian Lavery not had to stand down when he has faced a series of very credible questions about the goings-on in NUM? Again, because
that's the National Union of Miners, and about his mortgage payments.
Again, because there is no desire for him to go. Why did Kate Osamore step down? Because she believed that she had to go. And absolutely, if she hadn't believed that she needed to go, she would still be there. And this has always been, I mean, it's one of those other things where this has always been a feature of our unwritten constitution that
Do a bad thing, resign for it.
There is no reason you have to do that. It's just, you just do.
And I find the response to it just baffling, though. So I thought Clive Lewis, also in that kind of part of the party, really, had a very measured tweet which just said, you know, people defend their families, but it was the right decision for her to go. You know, thanks for your service. But the kind of Corbyn media outrider take seemed to be much more along the line of, it's terrible to see a rare black woman get hounded out of her job, which I thought, that is an analysis that I accept, but it's also, I mean, just being a rare black woman in politics does not give you license to threaten people with a bat.
Yeah, I mean, I think actually, to be honest, even the kind of, so what she said about the bat was, I ought to have hit you with this bat in the kind of past participle. But I actually think the thing is, right, is the misleading answers are enough, in my view. I mean, they clearly aren't enough anymore, because we live in this weird world in which Esther McVeigh somehow managed to resign as a hero, and then Amber Rudd's first PMQs, after only 4 months after having resigned for not being on top of what was going on in her department.
Yeah, which led to elderly people being deported to countries where they didn't speak the language and knew no one, and may have died over there before they got a chance to have their case heard.
Yeah, people going, oh, you know, your honourable predecessor, and it's just like, no, this is really, really bad for our democracy. But I think there are sort of two corroding problems in the kind of lack of shame. The first is that it makes people understandably really reluctant to suffer damage on their side, right? There are very few...
The arms race theory, right?
Yeah, right. This thing is like, seeing as we now know that you can lie to Parliament, the NAO can write a public letter calling you out on it, you are not asked to resign.
This is McVeigh.
Yeah, and then you can resign and still be some kind of hero, right? She's still treated as a legitimate political actor, which, I'm sorry, in my view, you are not a legitimate political actor if you do all of those things. So at that point, everyone, whether you're a Conservative Remainer, whether you're anyone in the Labour Party, you're kind of going, but why should we suffer political damage? And so what you then do is you have a variety of disingenuous takes, right? I mean, so let's take, say, the war on drugs. It's true that the war on drugs is a disaster. She did, however, stand on a manifesto which, despite her own opposition to it, did commit to continue the disastrous war on drugs. So it's a bit specious to then turn around and go, but this policy, which we are fully committed to backing, is bad. That should be some mitigation. But we are in this really, really troubling world in which, basically, the only time anyone resigns anymore is if they have the decency to resign themselves, because neither of our political leaders are going to do that. And considering that both of them have got away with it, it's this weird thing where I ask myself, if I was advising some future leader of a political party, should you lose your vital ally? I'd go, write it out.
Well, it's also complicated by Brexit, isn't it? And by the factionalism in the Labour Party, the pro-anti-Corbyn, which is that actually it's not just about wanting to not, you know, lose somebody that might be valuable in the fight against the opposition party. It's about losing against the own opposing faction in your own party. I think one other thing that I feel quite strongly about is about employing family members in Parliament. I've long been very side-eyeing about the fact that John McDonnell employs Jeremy Corbyn's son, which is a legacy of the time that they were both backbenchers. But, I mean, I think it was, this makes me feel like a million years old, but I remember you saying to me once that Ed Miliband had never faced a job interview in which he didn't already know the interviewer.
This is an observation I stole from a Labour MP who said to me that the thing that Cameron and Ed have got in common is they've never had an interview where they didn't know the person interviewing them beforehand.
Right, and I still feel the same thing, that actually probably Ismail Osamore did not maybe face exactly the same level of interview scrutiny from the fact when he was being employed in his mother's office and continues to be employed in his mother's office.
I actually do think Seb Corbyn is fine. He's not employed by his own relative. Most people do go into their parents' jobs.
Yeah, but politics is different, though. It's not like being a car mechanic or running an accounting firm.
But I think the other difference is that people really have to trust their staff. So I'm sort of intensely relaxed about the fact that there are loads of people who, yeah, that kind of rule, and if someone has the same surname as an MP, they probably are related to that MP, will tend to be a good rule of thumb. The reason why you shouldn't employ your own children is it does place you in the insidious and terrible position that you end up in a situation in which, like, this thing is, I think everyone would agree it is legitimate for a mother to lie to protect
their child. I don't think it's legitimate. Child. I think it's understandable.
Everyone thinks it is illegitimate for a politician to lie in those circumstances. I think it is legitimate for someone who has been charged and not received a custodial sentence to retain their job. In fact, I think it's actively desirable. But the problem is, because that person is also the child of the person they're employing, it becomes invidious. That's why you shouldn't do it overall. Whereas, yeah, I think actually people employing people they know in an office where you need to effectively trust your parliamentary staff with your life is fine. It's when it's your own family, however, you are always, most of the time, eventually, you are going to end up doing something.
You're
going to
throw something else under the bus
rather than your own child.
Which on a human level is completely understandable. And actually, I guess the other thing I would say in sort of Seb Corbyn's defence is that he has conducted himself in that role, from everything that I've seen and heard, impeccably, right? He doesn't throw his weight around and be like, hey, don't make me phone up Dad and have a word with you. So there is a kind of thing where I also think, well, that's a bit unfortunate that, like, the only person who isn't allowed to apply for a job in Parliament is an MP's relative. It's a very complicated subject. But I think we can agree on several things, right? So the war on drugs is bad and racially inflected. We can agree that you shouldn't throw water and assault reporters in the course of their job, which the NUJ condemned. You know, not a wildly right-wing body, the NUJ, so nice to have them on side on that one. Employing your children in Parliament is a fraught issue. And it is good that somebody who did something wrong resigned over it.
And our norms.
And our, your norms. Think of someone think of the norms. Yeah, well, thank you very much. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, hosted by me, Helen Lewis, and Stephen Bush. Recorded by India Book and produced by Nick Hilton. This week, why not just sign up to Morning Call? Please, for the love of God, sign up to Morning Call, and then I won't have to plug it anymore. In case you didn't hear us again, we are on the New Statesman podcast live on the 19th of December at Conway Hall from 7 p.m. If you just Google New Statesman podcast live, you will find it. Tickets are very cheap and we will have some special guests from the podcast bunker.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.